Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, and you've joined us for this edition of National Security This Week. We get together every Wednesday to discuss national security, and we're fortunate enough to be joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us learn more about national security challenges and opportunities. We're returning to the Russia-Ukraine conflict for today's show, but we'll inspiration from an historical foundation before we get into questions of policy. Our guest today is Professor Michael Kimmage from the Catholic University of the United States in Washington, D.C. Michael Kimmage has a wide-ranging academic policy and think tank experience. His expertise is on the former Soviet Union, the transatlantic relationship, and the history of U.S. foreign policy. His particular area of focus is the U.S.-Russian relationship. Kimmage is chair of the History Department at Catholic University. He's also the author of The Conservative Turn, Lionel Trilling, Whitaker Chambers, and the Lessons of Anti-Communism, published by Harvard University Press in 2009. And his most recent book, published in 2020 by Basic Books, is The Abandonment of the West, The History of an Idea in American Foreign Policy. From 2014 to 2016, Kimmage served on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff at the U.S. Department of State, where he held the Russia-Ukraine portfolio. He's a frequent contributor to Foreign Affairs, The New Republic, The National Interest, Internationale Politique, and War on the Rocks. Professor Kimmage is on the advisory board, chairs the advisory board at the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute, and he serves on the advisory board of the German Institute for International and Security Affairs. Professor Michael Kimmage, welcome to National Security This Week.
John, thank you so much for having me.
Where are you seated this morning? We're on Zoom, you and me, so we can see each other, but
I am on the campus of Catholic University in Washington, D.C.
So interestingly enough for our listeners, I'm actually doing this show remotely from a hotel room in Crystal City.
All right.
Washington, D.C.
Just across the river.
In Washington for a conference over at the Defense Intelligence Agency later this afternoon. Professor Kimmage, let's get into some discussions. I want to learn a little bit more about you so our audience knows who you are. You spent the bulk of your academic career looking at Cold War history with a specialization in the study of the Soviet Union and Russia. You also speak fluent Russian and fluent German. That's somewhat rare in the West. What was it about Russia that attracted you when you pursued your undergraduate degree at Oberlin and Oxford and your graduate degrees, including your doctorate at Harvard University?
Well, I have a family connection, not quite to Russia, but sort of to the region. And so, you know, the language was sort of a hovering presence in my childhood. Grew up in upstate New York in the 1980s, and the Cold War was in many ways present. There was an Air Force base in our town, and we just felt linked to the story that was happening over there in the Soviet Union, which was, of course, enormously dramatic at the time. Mikhail Gorbachev, Perestroika, Glasnost, the fall of the Berlin Wall. I was a sort of teenager when that happened and was captivated by that. And then as a college undergraduate, you know, the Soviet Union splintered into these different countries. It was a new Europe that was created. And I can certainly remember the optimism of that time. It really felt like a new beginning. So again, it was a very interesting moment to be studying these issues. And so I immersed myself more and more in the history of the Cold War, which felt like it wasn't really over in the 1990s. I'm not sure it's over today, but it felt like fresh and salient history. And then I was lucky to study in the UK and to study in Germany and to sort of travel in the region. That added a few other pieces to the puzzle. And then, as you mentioned, I had 2 years where I had the privilege of serving in the US government and working on Russia and Ukraine. And I think that the idea then, the boss that I had in the Office of Policy Planning is himself a historian. The idea then was that the history really matters and that we need to bring the history to bear on the crisis that was 2014, 2015 to fashion good policy. And I very much believe that. And I really believe in the back and forth between the patterns of history, what it teaches us about geography, what it teaches us about military capacity, ideology, all the motivations that go into warfare. And I believe that that really has to be in the back of people's minds when they address the big policy questions. So that's the interface that I'm really interested in working on, and I'm constantly going back and forth. What's the policy question of the moment, and where might history help us to figure it out?
That's the old saying, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it, right?
I think it's true, yeah, or at least doomed to to a certain kind of ignorance, which is really not what policymakers can afford. So it's not the only ingredient, to be sure, but it's a very, very important one.
Yeah, it has such a tremendous bearing on kind of cultural norms and those influences on how policymakers think about issues.
And in the case of the current crisis, it's obvious that Putin is obsessed with history. And I'm sure, John, you and I would not agree with a lot of what he says about history. But even to know that, how history can be a motivating force for political actors, you know, Hitler was obsessed with history in his own way. I think Stalin was as well. Maybe Saddam Hussein, you could sort of put into that category. These are all rulers that had a historical imagination, and you want to factor that in, even if you find it repugnant and crazy and deluded.
Right. So I caught the lecture that you gave on the Russia-Ukraine conflict that ran on C-SPAN 3 some time ago. I think it was maybe early fall. And I contacted you after I saw that to see if we could get you on the show. If we could, Professor, let's dive into our subject for today by providing listeners with a way to frame Russia's view of Ukraine based on Cold War history and maybe even going back further into the old Russian Empire.
Yes. You know, I think that there are two levels on which you can frame Russia's view of Ukraine, and I'll start with the more benign one. You could say on the popular level that Russia and Ukraine are neighbors and in so many ways deeply intertwined, that there is among peoples an extraordinary back and forth between these two cultures. I hope that Ukrainians wouldn't take issue with the point and feel like I'm, you know, sort of merging the two countries, which is not what I have in mind. But, you know, the border currently is, if I think about 12,000 miles or 12,000 kilometers between, 1,200 rather, miles or kilometers between Russia and Ukraine. And what's a very important regional dynamic is the scale of intermarriage. So even if you look at the names in the Kremlin and go into their family backgrounds, half of them are, you know, sort of Russian-Ukrainian. That would be true in the scheme of things for Gorbachev, for Khrushchev, for Brezhnev in the recent past, but there are commonalities of cuisine, there are commonalities of language, there are commonalities of religion, and since the 17th century, there have been commonalities of politics as well. There's a distinctive Ukrainian culture that, for sure, but you know, there is this kind of back and forth on the popular level. And that was especially so in the Soviet period when it was one country and a lot of people in the Russian part of it would have their vacations in Ukraine or, you know, sort of, again, family ties and ties of emotion and sentiment. I mean, on the Ukrainian side, it's obviously more complicated, but you could look at figures like Petro Poroshenko, the leader of Ukraine before Volodymyr Zelensky, and a lot of his business activity was in Russia. And Zelensky himself is a native Russian speaker whose entertainment career was as much in Russia as it was in Ukraine before he became the president of Ukraine. So that's there in the background. And that can be a good thing in the sense that, you know, neighbors have a tendency toward integration. You could think of the United States and Canada in this regard, or the United States and Mexico. The other track, though, is a lot less benign, and this is on the level of political elites, and it's, of course, necessary to begin with the fact that Russia, since the 16th, 17th century, has been an empire and has added territory, you know, sort of continuously from the 16th century to the 20th century, and part of that story of empire has been a will to dominate what you could describe as the Ukrainian lands. And, you know, that's a military story and that's a political story, but it's also an ideological story. So there is a narrative that has to been developed that you could describe as the Russian imperial narrative, which is that Ukraine is sort of the birthplace of a larger Russia. And that larger Russia is entitled to Ukraine because Ukraine is this organic part of Russia. And that's an ideological story that is told, to which Ukrainians have very powerful objections, but it undergirds this sort of effort or will to control Ukrainian territory. Now, if you want to take the Russian view of things, or a Russian view of things, you could say a part of this is about defending Mother Russia from outside invasion, from Napoleon, from Hitler, from the West, but you know, that's a very subjective point of view. To Ukrainians, this very often looks like an offensive posture, where it's an empire that's out to dominate, and that's certainly there on the elite level. And one of the best exemplars of that worldview is, of course, Vladimir Putin.
So it's based on what you're saying is that there's a very long history there on the part of the Russian people. And I'm just going to make a comment, something that I experienced myself. When I was deployed into Bosnia-Herzegovina, 1999, I got on the ground there just towards the end of the NATO air campaign against Serbia over the issue of Serbia sending troops into Kosovo. So you're talking about, I mean, these are all Slavic peoples, right, connected back through Ukraine and into Russia. And talk about long memory, long histories, you know, on the part of the Slavic peoples. They came up on the anniversary of the Battle of Kosovo Polje, which was 700 and some years in the past. And there were Serbs, Bosnian Serbs, who were still angry about having lost that battle to the Ottoman Empire 700 and some years later. And that, to me, as an American, was just I just could not compute that view of things. Is that kind of what you've seen in your historical studies of Russia and Ukraine and whatnot? This really long history that the peoples have going back centuries?
That is very true. Certainly on both sides, there's a very long historical memory. You could sort of pick out one example with Putin. His first name is Vladimir, and then he has a patronymic, which is a feature of the Russian language. He takes his father's name as his middle name, Vladimirovich. And so that's Putin twice named after Prince Vladimir, Saint Vladimir, who roughly 1,000 years ago is understood to have brought Christianity to the Eastern Slavic lands. And he's claimed as a great hero of Ukraine. And founder of the Ukrainian state, but obviously has a role to play in the narrative I was just describing of a sort of organic Russia connection. And this might all seem like ancient history and ancient symbols, but Putin put a statue of Prince Vladimir outside the Kremlin. And I think it plays a role in the way that he looks at Ukraine and even the way that he looks at the military situation in Ukraine. So the history is there. It's a part of the sensibility. That's very true, and that's distant from, I think, our experience as Americans, but it also moves political leaders in certain ways, and that too, I think, is a bit foreign to our experience.
Yeah. For our audience, you're looking at the National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Professor Michael Kimmich from Catholic University, and we're discussing the war in Ukraine. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit, and you can learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. To continue our study of this topic, Professor Kimmich, what can you tell us about U.S.-Russian relations since the collapse of the Soviet Union? You hear a lot about this, you know, different sources sort of frame it differently. How has the deterioration of those relations contributed to Russia's invasion of Ukraine?
Right. Well, this is, I think, really one of the key questions. And in some ways, there were a lot of bright spots after 1991. In the 1990s, you know, Russia and the United States buried the hatchet to a great degree. There were lots of meetings between Bill Clinton and Boris Yeltsin. It was called the Bill and Boris Show in the 1990s. And I think that they genuinely liked each other and were invested in building a better relationship, a better Europe, a better world. And, you know, that's sincerely a part of the story. You have what was called the reset between 2008 and 2012. This was with Dmitry Medvedev, who was president of Russia of a kind. I mean, Putin was kind of lurking behind him, but he was there as the president, and he and Obama did achieve quite a bit of stuff together, arms control. Russia at the time was helping the U.S. with its military operations in Afghanistan. There was some counterterrorism that the U.S. and Russia did together, and you know, the Trump years are difficult to characterize, but you know, there weren't that many overt clashes between Russia and the U.S. In the Trump years, and it was a bit hard to anticipate that things would go in the direction that they did in 2022 back in those years. So it's not all darkness. There have been, you know, ups as well as downs, but I think deterioration is exactly the right word. the word that you use in your question. The way that I understand it is that the two countries, and I really have Russian leadership in mind here because I think Russia as a country can be more diverse than that, but the two countries really have different worldviews. And that when the United States, especially regarding Europe, when the United States looks at Europe, what the U.S. says is we fought two world wars in Europe over the kind of nationalism that the Europeans had and the way that people pushed, big countries pushed small countries around. And so we really needed in 1945 and then again in the 1990s to build a peaceful order in Europe where every country would sort of have a place and conquest and imperialism would be a thing of the past. And that's been a pretty successful project for the U.S. and it's one that the U.S. is really invested in. Democrats, Republicans. I think Trump maybe is a bit of an outlier in this respect, but we can save that topic for another another conversation. But most American presidents have had that view. Certainly Biden does, Obama, George W. Bush, Reagan. You know, that's kind of mainstream American policy, and it's very important to the U.S. You know, I think Putin and the people in the Kremlin look at the world entirely differently, a more zero-sum view of the world. The view is the world is a rough place, countries attack each other, it's a dog-eat-dog world, and you kind of have to defend yourself in this world. And what Russia has, to Russia's regret, is a very insecure border with Europe, and it's sort of necessary to shore up that border. So there was what we were talking about before, the sort of imperial view, Ukraine and Russia as bound together, kind of a cultural, ideological perspective, but there's also a national security perspective that sees as sort of much power, influence, and territory on the Russian side as to the good. And, you know, in that sense, Russia and the U.S. just clash over Europe. So it's not a small difference of opinion. It's not as if they're arguing over a little piece of territory and just can't work it out. It's a difference of worldviews. It's a difference of what right and wrong looks like. It's a difference of how Europe should be configured. And, you know, I think that that makes this conflict something of a profound conflict, and unfortunately one that's probably likely to stick around for quite a long time.
As you've studied, you know, Russia since the collapse of the Soviet Union, I mean, Vladimir Putin has figured very prominently in Russian politics for a good portion of that time. Was there like a specific incident that happened or a series of incidents that happened that sort of pushed Vladimir Putin in the direction of we have to vilify the West? That I think is done for internal political consumption and solidifying his power base inside Russia. But it also puts Russia and the U.S. And our West, you know, allies in the West sort of at cross purposes, at loggerheads, based on the rhetoric. Was there something that triggered that, or what do you think?
Yeah, there are a lot of things you can say in response. One is that this is a strain in Russian life, Russian politics, Russian culture, going back to the 18th and 19th century. And for, you know, fans of literature, you would want to look at Dostoevsky here. He was a great writer, a powerful figure, and was deeply skeptical about Western life and Western culture, Western politics. And he put a lot of that skepticism into his literature. It's definitely a part of the Soviet experience where the West was regularly demonized, capitalist West, a kind of a certain story that was told. And it's something that Putin has not had to invent in Russian life. It's something he's just had to tap into. So just a few points about Putin himself. I think, you know, he lives through the collapse of the Soviet Union, not as an unambiguous good for Russia, but as a loss, and that Russia lost territory and influence in Eastern Europe. Of course, Putin was a KGB agent in the East German city of Dresden when the wall came down. And that, you know, I think gave him a particular vantage point. You know, I think that there's a confusing period with Putin when he comes to power in 2000, where he looks like something of a modernizer who's going to make a good relationship with the West. So he's the first person to call George W. Bush after 9/11. He speculates about Russia joining NATO in 2002, and he seems to want to bring, you know, Western politics and economics to Russia, on the surface at least. But that Putin didn't last very long, and I'm not quite sure why he starts to become more repressive in Russia. He was never a fan of democracy. That was there from the start. And the foreign policy just hardens and radicalizes over time. So 2007, Putin goes to Munich, to the Munich Security Conference, and he gives this fire-breathing speech about how the U.S. is screwing up the world and destabilizing things and guilty for Iraq and for many other things. And that's a speech But then a year after that, you have the Russian invasion of Georgia, where the U.S. and Russia are really coming down on different sides of the military equation. And so in 2014, you have the annexation of Crimea, invasion of Eastern Ukraine, pretty big steps. A lot of that is accompanied by mass media vilification of the West inside of Russia. You have tension in Syria, 2015, meddling in the U.S. election, 2016, which is a huge step to take. And then, of course, you know, 2021, 2022, Putin goes off the deep end and not only engages in a horrific and massive war, but really throws down the gauntlet to the United States and to the West. If we think that we're a small part of this war, we're making a mistake. Putin is making a bet against the United States, a bet against the West with the war. And that's something that Americans have to be very aware of. It's not a local conflict way over in Eastern Europe on the other side of the world between people who are far away from us and don't matter that much. It is something that really involves the U.S. and it involves the U.S. because of Putin's, what you would have to describe as his hatred of the West at the present moment.
Yeah, that's a great way to frame it. I do want to get into to those discussions about the war and the implications for that conflict between Russia and Ukraine. I would highlight for our listeners that you had two articles that just came out almost simultaneously. One called Wartime Putinism, which you co-authored with Maria Lippmann. And that was for Foreign Affairs, I believe. And then Putin's Last Stand, The Promise and Peril of Russian Defeat, which you co-authored with Liana Fix, also in Foreign Affairs. Those are both excellent articles that I think our listeners would love to read those things. Let's pivot over to Ukraine's perspective. I want to make sure we get a little balanced view here. What are the key historical points to consider from Ukraine's perspective as we review sort of the lead up to the Russian invasion of Ukraine?
Right. Well, let me just give a little bit of background, historical background about Ukraine up until 1991 and say a few words about the lead up to where we are at the present moment. So Ukraine is a distinctive identity, culture, people that in the modern period was, you know, sort of colonized from without by various different powers. This was the Russian Empire up until the 19th century. In the eastern side, it was Austro-Hungary or the Habsburg Empire on the western side. After the First World War, Ukraine is one of the big losers at the Treaty of Versailles. It doesn't get a nation of its own. And, you know, it's a complicated story, but an interesting one. And the western part of Ukraine falls within Poland. Eastern part falls within the Soviet Union after the First World War. After the Second World War, Stalin is able to take all of Ukraine and put it into the Soviet Union. And that means in 1991, when the Soviet Union unravels, you get an independent Ukraine that's a large country, 40 million in population and territorially very significant. Now, that country undergoes the difficulties of the transition from the Soviet period to the post-Soviet period. Those are economic difficulties, those are political difficulties. And so poverty has been a consistent problem in Ukraine. And you had a kind of back and forth pattern in Ukrainian politics where some leaders of Ukraine would incline a little bit more to the east and toward Russia, others would incline a bit more toward the west and toward Europe. And that was a kind of, in a sense, not very dramatic a story of Ukrainian politics. And that comes to an end in 2014. When the pro-Russian figure, Viktor Yanukovych, flees the country in February of 2014, and then Russia immediately annexes Crimea. And so that really creates a new kind of country that is more unified around Ukrainianness, much more skeptical or opposed to Russian influence. And that is the country that is, in a sense, created, you could almost say created by Vladimir Putin, in 2014. That's very important background to what we have at the present moment. Between 2014 and 2021, I wouldn't give Ukrainian politicians, this would be Petro Poroshenko and Volodymyr Zelensky, I would not give them great grades on their domestic politics. There's a lot of reform that they could have done. There's a lot that they could have done to make Ukraine sort of more, you know, economically viable, breaking down some of the sort of patterns of the past. That's an important conversation to be had, and that's a part of the story, I suppose. But what matters more is that Poroshenko and Zelensky did two things. First of all, Poroshenko invested in Ukraine's military modernization after 2014 because he knew that the country was under duress. And he starts to increase cooperation with the United States, with NATO on a certain level, with countries in Europe. But at the same time, in 2019, Ukraine holds a real democratic election. And, you know, Zelensky comes into office, 47 years old, former comedian, looks kind of like a lightweight, maybe. Maybe it's a kind of strange episode in Ukrainian politics. Maybe, but he's genuinely elected. He has the legitimacy that comes from being genuinely elected. And you don't see the regional divisions in 2019 in the voting patterns behind Zelensky. So we can all celebrate what Zelensky has done since the beginning of the war. He's obviously got extraordinary qualities of courage and leadership, that's for sure. But he's also got a foundation to build on, of a legitimate government and a country that knows what it is. And that's not Zelensky's creation. That's not what Zelensky sort of snapped his fingers and brought into existence overnight. That's been developing in Ukraine, obviously, long before 2014, but in a special way since 2014. So Putin, who believes himself to be a master strategist, has done something really quite counterproductive in his terms, which is to create a Ukraine that is enduring, cohesive, and militarily viable.
Do you think the annexation of Crimea sparked sort of a feeling of country identity and a bit of nationalism on the part of the Ukrainians? Is that what I hear you saying?
Well, you know, nationalism is a little bit of a complicated word. When it comes to Ukraine, it can be associated with the sort of Western parts and, you know, what's sometimes described in Eastern Europe as sort of ethno-nationalism, and that's, you know, there as part of the story. I think what may be more important after 2014 is a kind of sense of civic patriotism, and patriotism that encompasses those who are Orthodox Christians and Catholics, and of course Zelensky himself has sort of Jewish background. So there's a pluralism in Ukraine. That's a very important fact of Ukrainian life, religious pluralism. You know, there's Ukrainian language, Russian language, or have in the past been used sort of across the country, and it has regional variety as well. So it's not, you know, sort of classic nationalism as you might find in Lithuania or Poland, you know, sort of one language, one identity, one church, one sort of sensibility, but patriotism, a kind of civic patriotism that incorporates these sort of differences. And that's what 2014, and before that, of course, the Maidan Revolution, the kind of uprising that took place starting in November 2013, was a stimulus to that. It's a very important factor in the war because there's been a lot of volunteer activity. There's been a lot of sort of ground up patriotism and civic commitment that has kept Ukraine afloat during the war. So we need to figure out where that comes from and to sort of go back to 2014 and earlier and think about that storyline. Again, I think Zelensky is extremely important. I worry a little bit that our media makes this too much of a Zelensky story and maybe not enough of a Ukraine story.
Yeah, I think it's important to highlight that there is a significant difference between what patriotism is and what nationalism is.
Especially in Eastern Europe, where, you know, nationalism is a pretty fraught subject. And, you know, it's interesting also, I don't mean to go off on a tangent, but, you know, Ukraine and Poland have historically very bad relations. There are a lot of atrocities committed, you know, sort of in the past, and issues of territory and problems. And one of the interesting dynamics of the current war has been the ability of Ukraine and Poland not to get mired in that stuff. And part of that is because Ukraine is not pushing a hard nationalist line, but they are patriotic and committed to Ukraine. But that's the way in which, you know, nationalism could get Ukraine into trouble.
Yeah. Professor Michael Kimmage, we need to take just a very short break, about a 60-second break, as we recognize our sponsor, the Cybersecurity Summit. So I'll send it back to the studio.
National Security This Week is sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. The Cybersecurity Summit brings together cyber experts from industry, academia, and all levels of government to explore challenges, solutions, and opportunities in the cyber arena. The three-day summit includes speakers, workshops, discussions about advancing a cyber career, and keynote addresses by top leaders from across the cyber community. Learn more at cybersecuritysummit.org.
And we're back with Professor Michael Kimmage from Catholic University here in Washington, D.C. Professor Kimmage, you actually spent time at the U.S. Department of State from 2014 to 2016. You led the Russia-Ukraine desk during that time frame. We should remind people just once again that Russia seized Crimea from Ukraine in 2014. And that other portions of Ukraine have also been claimed by Russia since that time as well, specifically the Donbass region. Can you clarify for our listeners what the Russian claims are to these two areas of Ukraine? Do Russian claims have any merits, or is this just nonsense from a moot point, really, in history, global history?
Well, it depends a little bit on how you see merit. Certainly from the vantage point of international law, there's no merit to these claims. And certainly from the vantage point of treaties and commitments to which Russia was a signatory in the 1970s and thereafter, committing itself to the sovereignty of Ukraine, sovereignty of the countries of Europe, there's certainly no merit whatsoever in annexation or invasion. So, you know, there's no way in which I think people outside of Russia would give the time of day to any of these of these claims, and it's certainly the position of the U.S. government that these claims are fundamentally without merit. Beyond that, U.S. sees these claims as very dangerous, as the rudiments of an international order that's really unacceptable to the United States. But to understand the thinking of Putin, which is of course an important endeavor, we would want to understand what he had in mind. I mean, I think that the easiest way to understand the annexation of Crimea is as a kind of grab, something that Putin grabbed from Ukraine when Ukraine was in a period of real turmoil, because the leader of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, flees Ukraine for Russia in the third week of February 2014. Annexation of Crimea begins almost immediately. The Ukrainian government was in a state of paralysis, and it was really a bloodless invasion on the part of Russia. So it was done because it was possible. And then you have a certain amount of turmoil in eastern Ukraine, and Russia, I think, felt the need to insert itself. So on the one level, Russia was really improvising in 2014. And it felt like a set of opportunities that sort of fell into Russia's lap because Ukraine was in a state of sort of disarray, political disarray, for a certain amount of time. So that's one way in which sort of Crimea and eastern Ukraine was approached. Secondly, for Russian strategy and for Russian national security, Ukraine in general is important. Yeah. And Crimea and eastern Ukraine are, in a sense, very important. And Crimea is just unusual in this regard. It was a part of Russia until 1954, the Russian Soviet Socialist Republic. And Khrushchev gave it as a gift to Ukraine in 1954 on the spur of the moment. And that has always annoyed Russians when, you know, the Soviet Union fell apart and Crimea ended up in an independent Ukraine. That was understood to be annoying. A lot of the population of Ukraine prior to 2014 was, you have to use the term loosely, but sort of ethnic Russian, pro-Russian, highly Russian-speaking. There was a hiccup of separatism in Ukraine in the 1990s, and it was good material for Putin to work with. And then most unusual of all, Russia was leasing from the government of Ukraine its naval port in Sevastopol in Crimea. So that meant that the Russian military was already there in Crimea in 2014. So annexation was especially, in a sense, convenient or easy. And a lot of the population of Crimea was retirees from the Russian military who were pro-Putin, had a certain political bent that, again, made it very different from the rest of Ukraine. But Crimea is strategically important to Russia. That's clear. It's strategically important to the Black Sea. And, you know, that was another motivation that Putin had for annexation. Eastern Ukraine is much more chaotic and difficult to figure out. I think that Putin wanted to just create a poison pill for the new government in Ukraine. He didn't like them. He wanted to create chaos. This was a kind of lever. It was a sort of mess. And what was convenient to Putin on a certain, you know, level was that he could up the level of chaos if he wanted to. He could scale it back. It made Russia a part of the diplomacy of Ukraine. So it seemed to give Putin influence in Ukraine. But I wonder if Putin wasn't deluding himself about that, because it poisoned the relationship with the West, what Russia was up to in eastern Ukraine, but it also poisoned the relationship between the Russian government and the people of Ukraine, which I can't imagine is really in Russia's long-term interest. So I think that there are ways in which the annexation of Crimea and Russian invasion of eastern Ukraine, or the Donbass, as it's sometimes called, there are ways in which that really backfired for Putin. We tend to think of why did Putin do this and how was Putin trying to gain, and it made him more popular, the annexation of Crimea in Russia. But I think it also created for him a set of problems that became unresolvable. And his resolution then was to invade on a huge scale in February 2022. And that's gone very badly for Russia. So in a sense, the mistake of 2022, it begins in Crimea for Russia. That's my take, at least.
Yeah. From one more question from a historical perspective, if we think back to the Crimean War, Crimea was part of the Russian Empire back
yes.
then. So, and the Western powers, the Brits, landed there, carry out a siege for a while. I mean, that was a full-scale war. That was not, I mean, so historically, Crimea has been part of Russia. I just want to reemphasize that because there's a question I want to ask you later sure. in the show about outcomes, peaceful outcomes. In the meantime, I want to get to the Ukrainian side of this. Ukraine flatly rejects all of these Russian claims to sovereign Ukrainian territory. Is Ukraine right to hold these positions on the Donbas and in Crimea, considering where things are at in the modern world?
Absolutely. I think that there are, you know, is the easy answer to your question, which is that, you know, for any country, the most important thing that you can do is defend yourself and, you know, defend the territory that you have. And it wasn't catastrophic for all of Ukraine when Russia annexed Crimea and took over the Donbas. I was with my State Department colleagues in Kiev in January of 2016, and Kiev didn't feel like it was a city at war then. It was a thriving, happy metropolis, and a lot of Ukraine was flourishing then. So yes, it didn't devastate the country 100%, these actions, but it's a terrible thing to lose territory psychologically. It just violates a country's basic integrity. So there's that answer to the question, but there's another answer to the question, which is in a sense more ominous. What Russia did with Crimea after 2014 was to heavily militarize it. It was militarized already, but that proceeded apace. The same was true of those territories that Russia controlled in eastern Ukraine. And then it used those militarized territories to invade the country, going for the capital city, making a lunge at taking over the whole country. So even if it was a kind of legal abstract question, Crimea, about sovereignty, about independence, that is about treaties and the kind of stuff of diplomacy, even if it were that, it would be bad. But this military component makes it terrible for Ukraine to have Russians present on their soil in this way. And, you know, that's going to be a huge, huge challenge for the Ukrainian government going forward, because they really can't compromise on the details, and yet the military configuration, I know that we're going to get into that in a moment, the military configuration for Ukraine that will be necessary to take back all of its territory, that's not going to be easy to acquire. But there's no way, I think, in the future, any leader of Ukraine, whether it's Zelensky, whether it's somebody else, could tolerate the dividing up of its territory.
Yeah. Professor Kimmage, let's look at possible outcomes in this conflict. I mean, it's been going on for almost a year, it'll be a year in February, late February. It seems pretty unlikely right now that Russia will achieve the war aims that Vladimir Putin stated at the start of the invasion, the quote-unquote special military operation, as he framed it back in February of 2022. It's also entirely possible Russia might be forced to withdraw completely from Ukraine, as Western assistance to Ukraine is clearly tilting things in Ukraine's favor. Much more, not a lot, but some much more advanced ground combat equipment is heading their way. We'll see how much the NATO allies actually deliver, but some of it's heading that way. The Biden administration, our NATO allies, and the EU, the European Union, have all stated it's up to Ukraine and President Volodymyr Zelensky to accept whatever peace offers might be on the table. Not that there's been a lot of discussion on that yet, but from a regional historical perspective, and in your study of Russian history and diplomacy, what do you think are some possible outcomes that we could see in this conflict?
Right. It's really the question of the hour. It's the most important question for the Biden administration. And I think it's a question that matters a lot. I'll go back just to American citizens to say that this war is about us in some ways, because that's how Putin has defined it. And, you know, the U.S. is going to be a very important part of whatever solution comes in the future. So I think we as American citizens need to think about what the stakes are for us and what kind of outcomes would be tolerable and desirable. And unfortunately, it's a very, very hard question. As long as Putin remains in power, and that could be for a while, the piece that you mentioned, the wartime Putinism piece, suggests that the war is in many ways an empty operation for Russia because they're not going to win it. You know, Putin has enough tools of repression and, you know, enough Russians don't want to lose the war that I think he can keep it going for a while. And I think that we can assume that Putin will never compromise on Ukraine.
Yeah.
He's not going to give up Crimea, not willingly. And I doubt that he's going to give up the territories in the Donbass. That was in the bizarre ways in which Putin justified the war at the beginning. That was supposed to be the thrust of things, the kind of integration of these two regions, Donetsk and Luhansk, and the Donbass into Russia. That hasn't panned out very well for Russia. But if you define that war, the war that way in the beginning, I think that those are war names that are going to be very difficult for him to give up. So he's going to throw everything he can at this conflict to at least prevent himself from losing it. And I think that we have to just take that as a kind of basic assumption. Putin could fall. Military setbacks could really create domestic political problems for Putin. He's not, you know, as masterful as he thinks he is. He has a lot of vulnerabilities and weaknesses. That's very true. But I think those are for the medium term. I just don't see them coming to the fore in the short term. But I would be happy to be proved wrong on that point. You know, I think that Ukraine has a different set of challenges. They've performed, I think, better than many Ukrainians expected and many Western observers expected. And that goes back to what we were talking about before, that there's been a strong sense of patriotism and national commitment. But also just in raw military terms, I think that the leadership has been excellent. And they have handed Russia a series of major defeats around Kiev, around Chernihiv, around Kharkiv, around Kherson, and who knows where the next defeat may come to Russia. So that's an extraordinary story. And I think the Biden administration should be credited for the quality of the support that it's given to Ukraine. That's intelligence sharing, that's military support, and that's the construction of a coalition that's supporting Ukraine. That's not just Europe, but also Japan and South Korea, Singapore, Australia, Canada. Something that's really quite quite formidable. So the fundamentals have turned out well for Ukraine, and I think that they will continue to turn out well, but I am skeptical that Ukraine will be able to take back Crimea, and I am skeptical that Ukraine will be able to push Russia all the way out of the Donbass. And I also don't believe that a negotiated settlement is realistic. Obviously, the Biden administration needs to talk at every turn about diplomacy. You don't ever cut that off as an option. I hope that there are back channels between Washington and Moscow. Who knows, you know, when Moscow may change its calculus. We can't prejudge that. So the diplomatic conversation needs to be kept open, but I just don't see it bearing fruit for the first reason that I mentioned, that Putin is not going to give up on this endeavor. So my conclusion, maybe coming a little bit full circle in our conversation, is that we will go back to where we were in the 1940s with something like containment. I don't think we're going to find anything as neat as a Berlin Wall between Russia and Ukraine. I don't think that there'll be a clear line, but it will be, I think, a balance between the military forces on the Ukrainian side and Russia's military forces, and there will be this line of contact, and our goal will be to contain, to sort of minimize the spread of Russian military power in Ukraine. And that's maybe not a sweeping, grand, Hollywood-type conclusion to this conflict, but I think it's probably where we're going to end up. And I think we have the capacities to do well with that, but we have to have a lot of patience. That's, you know, I'm happy to develop that point, but I think patience is an ingredient on the Western side that is really of the essence.
That's a great point. We had a show a couple weeks ago with Elizabeth Shackelford, where she was talking specifically about this idea that we need to get back to using strategic patience and diplomacy as part of the core elements of American foreign policy, rather than deciding that everything looks like a nail and we use the military as the hammer to deal with it.
Absolutely. I mean, we do need to learn from some of the mistakes that we've made in the past, going back maybe to Vietnam. The other thing that we have to remember, and it's a grim point, but we've never been in this kind of kinetic, fluid military conflict with a nuclear power. This just didn't happen during the Cold War. This is a difference with the Cold War. Yes, there was Vietnam and there was Korea, and we were on the side of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. There were lots of proxy wars during the Cold War, but it was never this direct. And we are now pretty close up to a real military conflict with a nuclear power. And that doesn't mean that we yield to Russia. It doesn't mean that we grant concessions that we don't want to grant. But you have to have a certain respect for that set of circumstances. So if we see it as a nail that we can easily hammer in, we'll be making a pretty grave mistake. We have to navigate. We have to slow down. And we have to think, I think, not in terms of years with the war in Ukraine. We have to think in terms of decades. And that, I think, when we do that, our strategy will really come into focus.
Let me ask you some follow-up questions on that, if I could. We're down to about 14 minutes left in the show, unfortunately. This hour goes by so quickly. I'm just amazed every week. Russia announced a conscription back in September. They just announced another plans to add another, I think it was 500,000 troops to the military. They have been expending a tremendous number of ordnance. They are really burning through ordnance fast. They still have plenty left, but it's amazing how much they've expended so far in just the last 11 months. They have lost a significant number of tanks and armored personnel carriers and helicopters and everything else. These things, is this a signal that he's like all in on regime change in Kyiv? Or is this just a signal that they're going to re-strengthen the military and NATO better not try to take advantage? How do you read this?
Well, I think it's certainly the highest stakes conflict for Russia imaginable. Putin has certainly staked his presidency on this war. He sees it, I think we can say that he sees it as existential for Russia, and he is going to sort of do what he can and muster the resources that he can to go forward. I mean, that said, the decision to invade, we're now not looking at the world through the eyes of Vladimir Putin, but through different eyes, the decision to invade was a horrific mistake for Putin and for Russia. The sheer decision, so we can speak about how the tactics haven't worked out and Russian generalship and morale and all of that, and a lot of that has been disastrous, but the absolute decision, or the simple decision to invade, was an enormous strategic blunder for Russia, and that in part explains why the war has gone so badly. But I think what one senses, and it's hard to piece this together from the outside, but we can try, what one senses is that the information loops in the Russian government and the ability to really sort of talk through problems and difficulties, all of that is clouded by the kind of dictatorship that Russia has become. So, you know, that ammunition question should have been discussed in the Russian government early on, and maybe they should have held off over the summer instead of pounding the Ukrainians with all kinds of ammunition fire and actually not achieving a lot with that. They should have taken another tack, or, you know, sort of other matters. So they don't seem able to sort of recalibrate and rethink things. What they have settled on is brutal attacks on Ukraine's critical infrastructure and what feels to me like a sort of nihilistic response to the war. Okay, we're not going to go into Kyiv. We're not going to be welcomed as liberators. We're not going to slice off half the country and return it to Russia, as Putin thought at the beginning of the war. And maybe that has even settled in on the mind of Putin, that those kind of grand, heroic war aims, they were probably ludicrous to begin with, but none of them are going to come to pass. But it's sort of, what can we prevent? What can we dump on Ukraine to make it as dysfunctional as possible as a society? You know, remove their electrical grid or hit their water supply and all of this. And I'm afraid that Russia on that level can do quite a lot of damage. And what they're going to turn this war into, I think they've done this already, is a test of Western resilience. Okay, you guys want to support Ukraine. You think Ukraine's great. You think Zelensky's great. How much are you really willing to put up? How much money? How much endurance? How many refugees are you willing to sort of bear to keep going and to sort of prevail in this war? And I think there, even if Russian thinking has sort of become more depressed over the last 11 months, and I suspect that it has, I think that there's still a certain amount of cynical optimism in this regard. We're sort of tougher. We can hold it out more. We can deal with the inflation. We can deal with the economic problems. We can deal with mobilization. We can take the casualties. We can do all these things. But in our view, the West cannot. And so Western support for Ukraine at a certain point is gonna falter. But it's an enormously empty way to think about a war, to give up on the notion of real victory, and just to think of civilian suffering as a way to achieve a kind of, a kind of muddling through outcome. It's very, very grim to behold.
Maybe the strategy is to destroy any means of having a functional economy in Ukraine, which will set them back 20 years.
Exactly.
For our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Professor Michael Kimmage from Catholic University, and we're discussing the war in Ukraine and Russia. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. You can learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. So, Professor, we only have about 8 minutes left in the show this morning. If we could, let's take a look at the U.S., the role the U.S. might play at this point in the crisis. If you were advising the National Security Council right now on ways to facilitate a peaceful resolution, what might you suggest? You've studied the region, you've studied Russia, you studied diplomatic history and U.S.-Russia engagement going all the way back to World War I. Is there a path forward where the United States can help Ukraine to achieve a peace that ensures their sovereignty, but also, critically here, saves face for Vladimir Putin and Russia?
I don't know if it's possible to thread that needle. I suspect it isn't. And that's in large part because of the zero-sum way that Putin understands the conflict. And there's a vicious circle element to this that Putin resents, fears, dislikes Ukraine's connection to the West politically and militarily. His war has made that connection a whole lot stronger. But in some ways, and it's a bit perverse, that makes Putin even more eager to sort of pursue the fight in Ukraine, and not just in Ukraine, but across the region. And there are probably tools that Russia has, cyber tools and other tools that it's not used so far, but that it may use in the future, not just against Ukraine, but against the countries that are supporting Ukraine. So let's not assume that the war has reached its highest point. I think that may still be to come. So the U.S. has to deal with that. In no sense does Putin's zero-sum logic mean that we scale back our support for Ukraine. We've made, I think, an honorable commitment and an intelligent commitment to Ukraine's sovereignty and security. I think that we'll probably have to juggle two different balls. And the first ball will be sustaining civilized and decent life in Ukraine. I don't think we can think at the moment of all of Ukraine because there are parts under Russian occupation. Until we could reasonably understand a way to get the Russians out, we'll have to just think about the parts of Ukraine that are not under under Russian occupation. But how can we, and it's not just military support, it's also going to be supports for civilian infrastructure and for schooling for children and for medical services. I mean, that has to be a holistic effort. Obviously, Europe should be front in line when it comes to that, but the U.S. should be working hand in glove with its European allies to sustain Ukraine in all the ways that the word sustain, all the meanings of the word sustain. And that's going to be one difficult ball to juggle for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And again, I would emphasize decades as the right unit of thinking about this this conflict. The other ball that we're going to have to juggle is containment of Russian influence and power in Ukraine, in the Balkans, among Ukraine's neighbors, Turkey, really across the region, this very large region that Russia touches upon, containing Russia's military power and influence, making sure that it's not spreading and growing. And that's a lot like U.S. policy during the Cold War. And also like U.S. policy in the Cold War, we have to be careful about unnecessary escalation. And I think the Biden administration has been disciplined on this point so far. So no uniformed American military going into Ukraine, that's the right call. You know, maybe certain kinds of weapons should not be provided to Ukraine for the sake of avoiding escalation. We should definitely signal, as we have, to the government in Ukraine that we don't want Ukraine using U.S. weapons to strike inside of Russia. That's probably a step too far. So, you know, these are up for debate. I know that there are lots of experts who think differently than I do on those points and would just say, go at it. And, you know, by any means necessary, and there might be a good case for that. But I, for one, am happy that the Biden administration is concerned about escalation. So you contain with one hand and you sort of try to keep the escalation under wraps with the other, again, as a way of sustaining the policy. Final point I will make about U.S. policy, and I think that the Biden administration has work to do here. They need to talk to the American people about it. They need to go out to places like Minnesota. They need to go out to places like Michigan, Wisconsin, North Dakota, Arizona, where there may not be a strong sense that Ukraine is, you know, close to us. It might seem further away than it does on the East Coast, because, you know, there are diaspora populations in the East Coast and certain linkages. And the Biden administration really needs to make the case. Why does this matter to Americans? Why do we need to support this? Why is this not a cause just for Democrats? It's for all Americans to be invested in. And the next administration, whichever one it is, should be given the gift of that broad-based support on the popular level. And I think Biden administration has been, policy-wise, they've been shrewd. The politics of this, they could do better because it's, you know, it's not self-evident to most of us and it's not always clear. And that case really has to be made.
I do want to ask one follow-up question that's probably going to push us a little over our time limit today. Can you stick around for just a couple of extra minutes? So Russia has invested, a tremendous amount of resources into this war with Ukraine. Putin has, over the course of his time in leadership, really exercised a lot of tools, the tools of national power, as we say, to sort of gain control and influence everything in the Russia near abroad. Is he losing control of the near abroad because of what's happening right now? I've heard some really interesting reports out of the Central Asian nations, not just Kazakhstan, where there was a bit of a flare up here, but the others, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan. What's happening in the Russian periphery that is catching your attention?
Right. It's not that Russia has lost control. It still remains a powerful actor in the region, in part for economic reasons. They're also Russian-speaking populations, and in the case of Central Asia, lots of people who work in Russia and send remittances back to Central Asia. And it's not like that has just stopped overnight. In many ways, Russia remains a power player across what it describes as its near abroad. But I think it's objectively the case. I don't think it's wishful thinking on our part. I think it's objectively true that Russia has weakened itself. And one thing that it's shown itself to be, it's really not what you want to do as a dictator or as an autocrat, it showed itself to be fallible, inefficient, incompetent. I think we've all been a bit shocked by the kind of low performance, low quality performance of the Russian military. So Putin himself has reduced the fear of Russia, not 100%, but he's diminished it. The other thing that's happened is that Russia is distracted. The whole weight and energy of government in Moscow is now going toward the war in Ukraine because it's a huge operation and because they're in many ways losing the war. So it's just a consuming subject, and they have less ability to deal diplomatically with other areas and other crises. And I think where you see this most strongly is in the South Caucasus. So Azerbaijan, yeah. Armenia, Russia, in the way that it does, sort of played both sides against each other and was sort of the broker in the middle. In 2020, it brokered a peace between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Now you have Azerbaijan pushing the envelope there, shutting off transit routes and doing certain things. Russia is supposed to be the partner of Armenia, but it's sort of asleep at the wheel, or it's just not it's not present, because I think that in Moscow there are too many other things that are going on. So it's losing clout in that respect. And then we'll just sort of see where the Russian economy goes. But GDP is declining in Russia. Certain technological changes are going to be a lot more difficult because of sanctions. Russia's throwing huge amounts of money into the war. So it just may have less to offer in that regard as well. And of course, China is picking up the slack there and sort of pulling Russia a bit more coercively into its orbit, which is another way or manner in which Russia is sort of losing influence. So again, the point about this war being a strategic blunder for Russia, you can look at the Ukraine component of that, but you might want to look more broadly at the way in which Russia has shot itself pretty directly in the foot.
I see, especially in the Central Asian nations, as an opportunity for the United States to engage in some really excellent dialogue and support. Professor Michael Kimmage, you have a relatively new book, came out in 2020, The Abandonment of the West. Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
Sure. So that book is a kind of history of American foreign policy going back to the 1890s, and it acknowledges certain problems with the strong commitment historically of the U.S. has had to this notion of the West, meaning sort of Western culture, Western civilization, that this has at times been an excuse for a racist way of conducting business and looking at the world, and at times has led the U.S. to sort of a kind of crusading foreign policy adventurism. So that's one part of the argument, but I think the bigger part of the argument is that this connection to the West has been very important for the U.S. Over time, and that what the U.S. took from the Western intellectual tradition was a commitment to liberty and self-government with the American Revolution, but very importantly, it wove those two ideas, liberty and self-government, into its foreign policy, especially in the 20th century. That's sort of the best of the American foreign policy tradition, and that's not what we want to abandon. We sort of want to remember how important that is. So that book is 2020. I'm sort of glad to say, in a way, although I hate everything about the war that's being fought in Ukraine, that a lot of what I was thinking about in 2020 in terms of what we should do, I feel like we have been pretty good about doing over the course of the last year. So have we cared about liberty and self-government in Ukraine? I think the answer is yes. It matters for our security. It matters for the larger relationship with Russia, but it's significant that in 2019, Ukraine held a democratic election and that Zelensky is a Democrat. That is an important part of the story. Have we worked hard to keep the transatlantic alliance up and running and make it an alliance that's dedicated to certain values as well as to hard national security interests? I would say that the answer to that question is also yes. There are lots of things to worry about on the horizon, lots of problems, but I think in terms of where we were in 2020, I would say that the U.S. is in a pretty decent place in 2022 when it comes to being committed to the West and being committed to what you could describe as the best of this sort of Cold War story. There, too, I was thinking about the Cold War. What can we learn from the Cold War? That's what I'm always trying to think about. And again, there were lots of things that went wrong for the U.S. during the Cold War, but the commitment to Europe, the commitment to West Germany, commitment to a kind of humane and decent West was really, to me, the best of U.S. Cold War policy. And so I think we as Americans try to keep on learning from that history as we face the perilous crises of the 21st century.
Unfortunately, we definitely hit the end of our show for today, today's edition of National Security This Week. Professor Michael Kimmage, thank you for sharing time with us today and teaching us, really, about Russia and Ukraine and why this current conflict is so important. I'll just remind people, Professor Kimmage, that you had two articles that literally just came out, co-authored with Maria Lippmann, an article called Wartime Putinism, What the Disaster in Ukraine Has Done to the Kremlin and to Russia in Foreign Affairs, and then also Putin's Last Stand, which is in the current edition, current issue, I guess, of Foreign Affairs, Putin's Last Stand, The Promise and Peril of Russian Defeat, with co-authored with Liana Fitz. Both excellent articles. Excellent.
Thank you.
That, unfortunately, closes out the edition. Professor Michael Kimmage from Catholic University, thanks for joining us.
John, thank you so much. It was just a joy to be with you.
That closes this edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. Look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week. Have a great finish to your week and a fantastic coming weekend. Take care, everyone.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns with host John Olson. It's brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check their website, cybersecuritysummit.org, for a listing of their upcoming webinar series.